This is Car Expert.
The new car still feels like a BRZ, but it's immediately noticeable that the engine is far happier to pull from down low.
It's a company called Airspeeder, and they have innovated the future of flying cars. We will race the flying cars that have been built.
I think Australians have become a lot more accepting of Chinese cars of late because Chinese cars have just gotten so much better.
Hello, my name is Mandy Tim. G'day, William Stopford.
G'day, Mandy.
G'day, James Wong.
Hello. Mandy, it almost sounded like you forgot your name for a second.
A little, yes. Only episode 2 into this year and I'm like, who am I again?
Yeah.
I can see why you're smiling, J-Wo, because you've just jumped out of probably your most favourite brand in the world.
Yes. Well, I also smile because I spend a lot of money on my teeth, but the listeners kind of see that kind of. I've actually lived out a childhood dream, and something that I probably said to you, Mandy, one of the first weeks that I ever walked in telling you my aspirations as an automotive journalist was to one day drive an Aston Martin. I've driven a Bentley. I've driven an Aston Martin now, and Aston is actually like my favorite brand of all time, not because of James Bond, but more because I started playing video games very young and took to racing games first and foremost. And one of my first experiences with Aston Martin was winning or buying an Aston Martin on Gran Turismo 3, and then it became a bit of an addiction after that. And once I managed to win the original first generation Vanquish in one of the championships in the harder circuit, I fell in love. And so ever since, I've just been obsessed. I don't know what it is. I think it's just the way that they're designed. And I seem to have an appreciation for British brands in particular, sort of like how Will is obsessed with American stuff. I'm very British-oriented, and I don't really know why. Maybe it's because they love green as much as I do and a tan interior. But, yeah, so I've actually spent the last day or so driving the Aston Martin DBX, which is, for those who don't know, is their first SUV or crossover, and it sort of replaces the Rapide sedan or limousine in their lineup. It's an interesting car because it's obviously, you know, a jacked up vehicle that has the front of a DB11 but the rear of a Vantage, very similar to how the old Rapide had the front of a DB9 and the back of the old Vantage. And it has 5 seats. It's got a huge boot. It's got air suspension. It's got a Mercedes AMG twin turbo V8 under the bonnet, which sounds a little bit different, which I'll get to in my written review, which will come up in the next few weeks, I guess. But I've got a stack of social content to share. I've started drip feeding some of the photos I took at Port Melbourne Beach on my Instagram, and hopefully the Car Expert page will share them as well. I've got a little social video coming up in our new format, which we call, I think, the 60-second review. So I've got a couple of little things in there, but it's a really cool thing. And I was actually pleasantly surprised, having driven the Bentayga V8 not too long ago, which was my first real taste at driving in that brand's showroom. It was quite interesting to see the different personalities between the two cars. And I actually thought that the Aston really, really does feel like an Aston, probably because any Mercedes links in the DBX are sort of echoed throughout the rest of the lineup. They all have the old command system as their nav, and they have a couple of switches here and there and the indicator stalk. But other than that, the rest of the car feels very bespoke and very fitting of the price tag. Like, this one had this beautiful smooth leather everywhere, and the spec of the exterior paint was this icy blue. It was like a silver with a very slight icy blue tinge to it, and the leather was smooth and black with red stitching, and it looked fantastic inside. And the V8 engine sounds awesome. So very small teaser there, and I'll have more to say in the coming weeks. And stay tuned to our social channels because we've got some fun social content in there as well.
Yes. Did you coordinate your outfit with the car, James?
Thinking that.
Yeah.
Look, I had more to the outfit, which we'll hopefully see. I got our photographer, Sean, to do a – some people might say it's a William Stopford style aspect of the photo shoot, but I'm actually the OG of this kind of stuff. So I've got this time, instead of having it on my iPhone, I got him to take it on a camera. So hopefully the lighting and everything looks a little bit better. So But the DBX was the centerpiece of this. I may have I've been working on my fitness, but I wasn't the front and center bit of this thing. So no, but all jokes aside, to live out a childhood dream of mine, as well as just getting to experience something that I probably wouldn't have experienced any other way unless I became a crypto investor, like a recent hacking scandal on my Instagram may have led you to believe. But you know, to deal with a car that's that kind of money, it's like $360,000 plus on roads and before options and everything. It really is just a really cool thing that it's just, I don't even know how to describe experiencing something like that. It's just really, really, really cool. Whether you're a car enthusiast or just a, you know, a lifestyle and luxury brand enthusiast, it's just, you know, it's like when you get to touch your first designer bag or wallet or something, I guess, or, you know, buying your first Rolex. None of those things, which I've done yet. So I've gone straight to the cars. Really, really cool. So I'm a bit chuffed today. I've had a really good day, and it's been a good time. So I'm keen to share more about my experience, as well as some of the social content that we've got coming.
Now, guys, I don't really want to be a Debbie Downer coming off such a happy Harry here, but I don't even know if that's a thing. I just made that up.
Wow, we're making a thing.
Yeah.
Why don't you just make it a Jolly James moment, since we're just doing, yeah, you know, this phonetic punny things.
Now, we've spoken about this sort of stuff in the past on the podcast about how Tesla autopilots have got drivers into trouble before. But, well, it's actually turned a little bit serious because a driver has been charged with vehicular manslaughter.
Yeah, so it's believed to be the first time that someone in the US has actually been charged with vehicular manslaughter for something relating to a semi-autonomous driving system in their car. So Kevin Georges Izriad was behind the wheel of a Tesla Model S at the very end of 2019. He was traveling at a high speed. The vehicle left a freeway and ran a red light. It hit a Honda Civic that was occupied by two people who actually died at the scene. Riyadh and his passenger were hospitalized with non-life-threatening injuries. So he's pleaded not guilty. He's currently out on bail. But yeah, you're right. The autopilot has been in the news. And, you know, it makes me think of those jokes we used to hear back in the day about people being really ignorant of what cruise control was. They'd be like, I could just press this and sit back. And a lot of people seem to think that autopilot, both in Teslas and in planes, is something that will just do everything for them, when it is not. It is a level 2 autonomous driving system, and you need to keep your damn eyes on the road at all times and be prepared to intervene and, you know, ideally keep your hands on the wheel. So the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration in the US and the National Transportation Safety Board are both currently investigating the alleged misuse of autopilot. We've certainly seen some very high profile stories with autopilot. Remember that idiot last year that was sitting in the back seat of his car like a moron while autopilot was on. But the NHTSA has actually been a little bit critical of Tesla for having a system that permits the driver to disengage from the driving task. Now, Tesla will say that they put disclaimers on things and they'll warn, you know, occupants to, you know, keep your hands on the wheel and things like that. But there's certainly been a lot of criticism over the past few years about the extent of autopilot's abilities. And now with full self-driving, which is an even more deceptive name, because you can't even say, well, you just misunderstand what that term usually means. No, it's implying something it's not. Again, it's a level 2 driving, autonomous driving technology. There was another collision in 2018 that the NTSB was investigating, where someone was, again, a combination of the car wasn't smart enough to react to something, in this case, a barrier that had been knocked out of place, but also the driver was reportedly doing something they should not have been doing. Apparently he was playing a mobile game while he was driving, which I don't even play mobile games while I'm stationary, so I really can't understand that thought process. And then there was another crash the NTSB was investigating, where fortunately nobody died, but there was a fire truck parked on the road, and the person was clearly not paying attention. They had autopilot engaged. They ran into a fire truck with its lights on.
pretty hard to miss a fire truck. Ooh. It makes me think of those ads. I don't know if you had them in Victoria where it's like, charter boat? What charter boat? All the Queenslanders listening have just probably laughed. In that instance, the driver's hands had been detected on the wheel by the car for 78 seconds out of the 29 minutes he had autopilot activated for. So there's certainly a lot of criticism to go around for Tesla in terms of like how they market their systems and their abilities, et cetera. It's also worth pointing out as well, there's a lot of people that are abusing these systems and misusing them.
This is probably something that I've said before, but I think this is an area where I think Tesla needs to perhaps change its strategy, because I feel like the average Tesla consumer is not your typical car buyer, and usually they either don't give a what about cars to begin with, or they're so focused on the tech that, when you go and buy a new phone or you go and buy, something from JB Hi-Fi and they tell you what it can do, you just immediately believe it and you're happy to test out the capabilities. But when Tesla is using terms like autopilot and full self-driving, when the consumer may not be across the legalities around that and also the limitations, I think it's quite dangerous. And this is something that we've seen for years with Tesla's autopilot and self-driving systems, in that, maybe one day it'll be capable of doing this reliably. The whole process, they're using user submitted information and data to help improve the systems constantly. And I think that Tesla has been, a trailblazer in the electric space, in the automation space for transport solutions. But I think when you put the average person, and this is not even just the average car buyer, the average person responsible of a moving vehicle at, certain amounts of speed, there has to be some sort of disclaimer or something that's clear enough that people don't just go like, oh, I can sit in the back seat with my hands off the wheel and a movie running on the center console because I can. Either these features can't be used, or they have to be turned off, given Tesla allows to switch things on and off with over the air updates anyway. Surely they're capable of doing that, because they have the beta program as well, where people are uploading videos of their Teslas just going wild on a public road with like people walking around and stuff. Like, this is people's lives that you're playing with, regardless of whether you're behind the wheel or on the street. This is a real thing that needs to be discussed. And I think that while it's amazing that Elon Musk is so outspoken and really believes in the work that he and his company are doing, I think that when you sort of have to account for the lowest common denominator and not trying to be too offensive, a lot, like, I wouldn't even know half the stuff that goes on in a Tesla, because it's such a different way of motivation compared to conventional cars. So when you're putting somebody that has even less knowledge than we do as, journalists and professionals in the industry, then, you have to, the opportunities are limitless in the worst possible way. And we've seen that now with people being killed, crashing into things, getting seriously injured and stuff. And, not to poo-poo Tesla, because they're doing amazing things. But, I think that people need to be educated. And, we talk so much about level 2, level 3, level 4, level 5 or whatever, when in the online configurator, when they're explaining the options package to you, basically saying that it can drive itself, like, I think that that's something that perhaps needs to be looked at. And this is across any other manufacturer that does this. I'm not 100% sure on all the other ones that do that, because there are some, this is why we need standardized terms across the industry, because you have people saying it's city brake and autonomous emergency braking and miss acceleration alert and all this kind of jargon that everyone's just going to think, oh, it's like this and like that. And, we can only do so much to explain it all, but, you still have to leave it up to interpretation. So I think it's something that needs to be talked about in a much broader way, and it's not just confined to Tesla. It's across the whole industry, and less, not as extreme as full self-driving. It's just simple features that I think the average buyer needs to be able to walk in and know what they're getting themselves into. Because if you go in there thinking that you've got this a level of capability that A, is not even legal in some places, and B, quite dangerous if abused, then, that's a public health and safety risk, or OHS or whatever you want to call it. And, once someone's gone, you can't bring them back. So, no amount of money or compensation is going to do that, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a massive talk topic. And look, we're keen to hear your thoughts as always, podcast@carexpert.com.au. Now, let's start with news, J-Wo, a little bit of a car expert exclusive. We've got some shots of the Avil H6 GT in Australia.
Yes, so one of our colleagues managed to snap the Havel H6 GT, which is known as the H6S in China. So it's sort of like, without saying H6 too many times, it's basically the coupe version. And we've been expecting them to confirm it for us for a little while. And after seeing these uncamouflaged photos, which appears to be like a commercial shoot, so they must be shooting brochures or like maybe a TV commercial or something, Havel Australia's confirmed that it is coming during the second quarter of 2022, though unfortunately we don't really have any other details regarding pricing and spec. So what we understand is that this will basically... this should run the same 2-litre turbo as the wagon version. It'll likely have a similar interior and will likely follow a similar equipment line. But we don't know those details yet. So stay tuned. But yeah, it looks kind of cool. We were sort of talking about this as a team the other day when we first saw the photos and sort of thinking about what kind of competitors that this car has. And when you really think about it, at the top spec Havel H6 Ultra all-wheel drive or whatever it's called is about 41 drive away. So even if the top of the range H6 GT snuck in just under 45, there's not really a lot of competitors at that end of the market. So maybe a few grand below, you've got a high spec Renault Arkana, or you go a few grand up and you've got an Audi Q3 Sportback. But this will likely be bigger than both of those and pack quite a lot of kit as standard. So it'll be this unique offering. And I'm already seeing so many Havel H6s around Melbourne. I don't know in Brisbane, Will, if you're seeing a lot of them as well, but I'm seeing a lot of all the Chinese branded cars at the moment, full stop, not just the Havels. But it'll be really interesting to see how that car is received, because it's quite an interesting and distinctive design. And I think that Havel's done a really good job in not just blatantly copying other brands. There's elements of things like, you know, it might look like a Kia or a Land Rover from some angles, and you can sort of see the connections. I believe a Land Rover designer designed the wagon. I don't know about the coupe. So you can sort of see the links there, but it has its own identity, and especially this one, that rear, the rear end sort of has elements of the latest BMW X6, but it's more square edged and it's got its own look. And so I think it'll be really interesting to see how it's received, because I think people are sort of not as off or weird about Chinese branded cars anymore. They're much more accepting and willing to take a punt on a new brand or a new product. So I think that they could be onto something here with this car if they can spec it right for our market.
I think Australians have become a lot more accepting of Chinese cars of late, because Chinese cars have just gotten so much better. And of course, there's a lot of things that are working in Chinese companies' favor, including other companies being unable to supply the market sufficiently. But you know, you're right about the way that H6 looks. It is genuinely a good-looking car inside and out. It has a lot of showroom and curb appeal, and I think probably the only thing that lets it down visually are the hideous logos and patches all over the freaking car. The coupe is very interesting, because in the Chinese market, we've historically seen coupe crossovers only in luxury brand lineups. But in the Chinese market, they're starting to become really common in mainstream brands lineups. So thus far, we've only really seen this is coming, the Arkana's out, yeah, the Citroen C4 maybe kind of counts as a coupe crossover to some degree. I'd be very curious to see how common this kind of layout becomes. One thing I will say as well about the styling, it looks meaner than the wagon up front. The rear, I mean, I'm not a big fan of coupe crossovers, but the rear is certainly aggressive looking. It doesn't have the full width taillights like the wagon does, which you can spy from miles away at nighttime, very distinctive. But there's some other little differentiating factors here, like the H6 GT is supposed to be getting front sports seats, which would be nice, and also apparently gets Brembo brakes as well. So, yeah, I'm very keen to see how much of a price premium it commands over the wagon and how well it's received by Australian buyers.
Do you guys reckon it's better looking than some of the European coupe SUVs?
Oh, it's not hard though sometimes.
That's a really interesting question. I personally think that I don't really draw the comparisons because they're all sort of funny versions of each other. Like even between, like you think of like Mercedes and BMW and Audi, they have three very different approaches to it. I personally prefer Audi's sportback styling because it's more conventional and sort of like, you know, sporty hatchbacky shooting brake style stuff. Like I think that the Audi Q8 is by far my favorite of all of them, even though it's technically not a coupe, but it's sort of a coupe. This one, I think it's cool because it's proportioned well enough that it doesn't look like it's uneven. Some of these have a habit of like being really light on for, you know, bodywork and cladding at the back, which makes them look like they're, you know, when you like you bend over to touch your toes, that's normally what I think of when I see these coupe SUVs. It's like just butt, skinny butt in the air, and it looks a bit funny because, yeah, it's sort of a weird way to explain it, but they just look like they're all the weights at the front rather than the back. And I think this one does a good job of keeping a consistent level of like weight through the lower parts of the body right through to the back, and then the midsection as well, those the fenders and the door creases and everything sort of extends through to the back, and the tail lights, all it all looks like it's, I'm big on like symmetry and like even proportion. So the fact that this sort of maintains those, that ratio from like top to mid to bottom for the most part without looking, you know, like it's too much. I could be proven wrong when I see it in person, but from these photos, I think it actually looks kind of cool. And it has its own identity from the wagon without being so far removed that it looks like an orphan. And also from the rear styling, sort of like what I was saying before, you can see elements from where it's been inspired by other brands or other models, but it still cuts its own line and you know, has its own identity, which I think is great.
Absolutely. Hey, Will, the Mitsubishi Outlander has earned 5-star ANCAP safety rating. So it should, because it's brand new.
Yeah, I made a lame pun in the Standfest for this article.
You did, and I actually laughed.
The Outlander smashed it with a 5-star rating. Oh, look, somebody's probably made that joke before. I don't profess to be that clever. But look, yes, so this is the second midsize SUV to be tested under the current 2020 to 2022 ANCAP protocols following the Hyundai Tucson. It received an adult occupant protection rating of 83%, child occupant protection rating of 92%, which is a nice number to reach, vulnerable road user protection rating of 81%, and safety assist rating of 83%. So the rating applies to all models currently on sale. Sometimes with ANCAP ratings, there'll be like one model that's excluded. Now, the upcoming FEV has not been tested yet by ANCAP, so we'll have to see if that rating carries over. But ANCAP had some very nice things to say about how the Outlander performed in the tests. It said that its protection of pedestrians and cyclists was quite impressive. It's actually the highest achieved to date in the midsize SUV category. The child occupant protection rating is the highest awarded under ANCAP's current testing protocols. That includes every car of every type that's been tested since the new protocols came in. They had a lot of nice things to say as well about the way the active safety and driver assist features work, including the AEB system, which has got pedestrian and cyclist detection. And it also has, and this is a feature that we're starting to see, and Hyundai and Kia, I know, have really been driving this, an AEB system that also includes a junction assist or junction turning function. So if you are turning at an intersection and there's a vehicle coming, it's smart enough to detect that and apply the brakes to prevent a collision. So that's available across the range, actually. So that's another thing that I found very heartening about the midsize SUV segment of late. Models like the RAV4 and the Tucson, the Sportage and the Outlander, you just get so much safety kit from the base model up. So it does make some of the older models in the segment, like your X-Trails and your CRVs, where some of those features are missing, all the more disappointing. So the Outlander, every single Outlander comes with AEB, like I said, an active blind spot assist feature, lane keep assist, adaptive cruise control, traffic sign recognition. And if you step up all by the very base model, also include rear cross traffic alert,
Not sure why that's not just standard across the range, but anyway, and reverse AEB. So yeah, the Outlander's done really well. And fundamentally, this is a family SUV, right? So to have a 5-star NCAP rating is obviously a very important selling point. So I imagine Mitsubishi is going to be emblazoning that across all its brochures and marketing collateral any minute now.
Now, moving on to the next story, Jack did a bit of a preview for us last week for the Tokyo Auto Salon, but we've now had some cars that have been revealed, and there's some pretty cool Toyotas in there, J-Wo.
Yeah, it's always a good time of year when there's a motor show and you get to see brands really go out there with some cool designs, especially given we've spent so much time at home and people probably haven't been able to do much. So it's also very good to see Toyota being very creative. So this Toyota GR GT3 concept, it's not actually based on any current model by the looks of things. And so I think we're all sort of wondering what this is previewing or what this foreshadows, because, you know, previously we've seen them reveal a Supra racing concept, and they currently race an RCF in GT3, and they have, I think, an LC500 for Japanese Super GTs. So motorsport is obviously very rich in the Toyota DNA, and I think that's what they're trying to bring back to the forefront with this GR branding and, you know, racing division and all that kind of stuff. But this GR GT3 concept is a mash of things. So I see a lot of, do you guys remember the BMW Z8? I'm getting a lot of that at the rear. I don't know about you guys.
It's getting that AMG GT at the rear.
I was thinking the same. That long bonnet as well.
I think the way that the lights are sitting in that bumper give me a bit of Z8 and the proportions, and then the front doesn't really sort of looks like the angriest and flattest Corolla I've ever seen, because it's got that really it's got a funny thing there. So I don't know where, and it's a two-door coupe, you know, does this mean that they're going to bring out a road-going version, because normally GT cars are based on production models, so is there going to be a car between the Supra and the LC500? We don't know. We don't even really know. I don't think we even know what powers it. So it's an interesting concept. And what Toyota said during the release is that this car is just designed to demonstrate the knowledge and refined technologies Toyota Gazoo Racing has gained in the field of motorsports, which is obviously very vague and doesn't give you a lot of information. But perhaps we could see this manifest over the coming, you know, Toyota likes to draw out their reveal. So if it's anything like the Supra, we might see the production model in 10 years. But, you know, we don't know whether it's a hybrid. We don't know whether it's a V8. We don't know whether it's turbocharged or any of these things. But it looks really, really cool. Perhaps it's a future Gran Turismo partnership.
I was going to say it looks like it's out of a video game.
Yeah, so maybe it's one of those. So hopefully we see more on this car very soon, because it would be very unlike them to do that. I know that they have that Le Mans prototype concept that's meant to become a production model in the coming years. I can't remember for the life of me what it was called, but it was this really cool like prototype hybrid thingy that's meant to have some crazy engine that I can't remember the specs of off the top of my head, but I'm really excited for that. So it's cool to see Toyota doing exciting stuff. Speaking of their production models, they also revealed the GRMN Yaris, which I believe is what you're referring to with Jack previewing last week, because they issued a couple of teasers before the event started. Unfortunately, this model is only going to be sold in the Japanese domestic market for the time being, and there's only 500 of them available. Interesting that they use the GRMN naming again, because that was what they used to call the European Yaris hot thing that was like supercharged and based on the old ones. So it was like really silly fast in a straight line, but based on the old Yaris architecture. So it was a little bit funny in the bends from what I've seen in overseas reports. But yeah, so they've based it obviously on the GR Yaris that we know and love at Car Expert. It's 10 millimeters wider, 10 millimeters lower, and 20 kilograms lighter than the standard GR Yaris. The first four gear ratios have also been shortened. The final drive is shorter, and there are mechanical limited slip differentials under the skin in place of the torsion units from the stock car. The power from the 1.5-litre three-cylinder turbocharged petrol engine is unchanged at 200 kilowatts, but torque has been bumped by 20 newton metres to 390 newton metres. The standard GR Yaris also has a really cool carbon fibre roof, which not long ago was reserved for something as cool as like a BMW M3 or M4 and then right through to exotic supercars. But now that they've released the GR MN, they've added a carbon fibre lip spoiler and bonnet to lower the center of gravity. And you can also option this really cool aero kit that makes it even beefier and puts this ridiculous gooseneck wing thing at the back. It's just wild. So the standard one sort of looks like a road-going rally car, sort of what we would have seen in Gran Turismo 3 about 20 years ago, you know, when they used to have like the racing version and you could unlock a secret road-going version mm-hmm. of everything. The normal one looks like that. But then you get the grey car that's in the photos on the website, and it's got all the extra stuff on it, and it just looks wild. Like, I can't imagine, like, I would love to see this kind of stuff here or something similar. You've got Recaro bucket seats inside, which, you know, it's just race ready. Like, I want to just jump in it and take it to the track.
Be a little pocket rocket, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. The normal one without the rally package is already a little pocket rocket. I can only imagine what this one's like.
Yeah.
So there's also a couple of other things in there. There's a rally style scoop to feed more air into the engine. The rear seats are gone when you get this car, and you can. The packages that I was talking about, well, the carbon options that I was talking about before, add things like the carbon options. You can also add a circuit package, which is available through Japanese dealers, which brings GR shock absorbers and stabilizers, extra underbody protection if you do rally stages in it, I don't know, or you miss the apex and go off track. Believe me, I've been there. And a GR roll cage. So that's the red car that sort of looks like the standard road going one. They just look so cool. It's a shame they're not bringing it here, but who knows, maybe we'll see something similar in the coming year or so, because I know that car's been like sold out and super popular here. So hopefully we get to see something along those lines.
It's nice that Toyota's released the GR Yaris, and they're continuing to release even more special versions of it. And this isn't all that Toyota's working at on the hot hatch front, because they've started a teaser campaign in the US for the GR Corolla. That's obviously going to be a very important model for their image in the US. So it's not necessarily going to be a high volume model, but it's very important there because they don't get the GR Yaris over there. But odds are, it hasn't been officially confirmed yet, but I believe it's been trademarked locally that the GR Corolla will come here. So Toyota, there was a period of time there where it seemed like they had kind of given up on exciting cars, but we're almost spoiled for choice. Supra, new 86, GR Yaris, GR Corolla coming, even their regular stuff actually handles decently nowadays. So
exciting times. Lastly, we've got another sort of video game-esque car that was revealed at the Tokyo Auto Salon, the Subaru STI ERA concept.
Yes. The STI ERA Challenge Project, which is such a long name. Fortunately, they abbreviated half of it. The ERA stands for Electric Record Attempt, because it actually has four electric motors and four-wheel torque vectoring technology. So it pumps out 800 kilowatts of power all up. The electric motors have actually been developed and supplied by Yamaha, and Subaru describes them as being a high torque, high revolution type for hyper EVs. So basically the whole idea of this concept is Subaru wants to set a lap time record of 6 minutes and 40 seconds in a time attack at the Nürburgring sometime from 2023 onwards. So it's describing this as a near future motorsport study project that they've developed for the aim of getting experience and training in new technologies, because obviously Subaru's never done a high performance electric vehicle before. So this kind of points to the future for Subaru motorsport, the future for Subaru performance vehicles. It's really exciting. It also noted that the four-wheel torque vectoring technology is also permitted under FIA EGT regulations. So they haven't said that they're planning on racing this yet, but it seems to be pointing towards something that they want to do. And it looks pretty epic as well.
That's it for the news. Click the news link at carexpert.com.au for more. A world racing series for flying electric cars? Yeah, that'll happen way into the future, you say to yourself, but no, it's here already. And Australia is in the thick of it. Aussie racing car driver Emily Duggan was the first female to race in the Australian V8 Touring Car Series and has had 12 wins, 33 podiums and 2 poles in her career. And now she can add Air Speeder Pilot to her resume. Emily Duggan, hello and congratulations.
Hello, thank you. It's crazy to, I never thought going into motorsport that this was going to end up being a place to be as a pilot.
Absolutely. Like, it's literally mind-blowing stuff. When I saw you release the news on your social pages, I'm like, what is this all about? So maybe I might just ask you that question. What is this all about?
Go ahead. So it's a company called Airspeeder, and they have innovated the future of flying cars. Matt Pearson, the founder, he grew up with and always was promised flying cars as a little boy. And as he grew older, he never saw that coming to fruition. So he said, well, if it's not out there, I'll create it. So that's exactly what he's done. And now throughout that, it's created the XR series, which is where we will race the flying cars that have been built.
So what exactly are the cars? Are they like typical EVs we've got on the road now, or are these like super scientific looking things?
Well, we describe it as F1s of the sky. In a way, it kind of looks like an F1 car in terms of the shape and everything and how the driver or how the pilot will sit in the cockpit.
Okay, wow. So does it, like, when you're in the cockpit, does it actually feel like you're driving a plane?
Well, I'm not in there just yet.
Okay.
So we're doing them remotely to start with. Obviously, all of this technology and the design and everything is so new. It's still really fresh. So getting into the cockpit, I'm not quite sure how far away, but not that far away into the future we are. And that's why they've brought us pilots on board to start training so that once everything's ready, we're ready to jump in.
Right. So you're actually going to be in a vehicle piloting it. It's not like, because on the social media teasers that we've seen show you driving it remotely. So this will actually be, you're in the vehicle.
Oh, heck yes. Jay Wong, you know me. I'm up for the risk and I'm up for the challenge. I'm signed up to jump in these things for
That's
sure.
Fascinating. What a cool development in motorsport.
What was your reaction when you were approached to be a pilot, Em?
So I was approached and straight away I was just like, this doesn't seem real. I mean, I think everyone's first reaction is like that. So straight away jumped on Google, researched the company and was just like, oh my gosh. Before I knew anything else, as soon as I just saw the website, I was like, heck yes. I was like, no matter what they say, no matter what they offer, yes, it's a go ahead.
How much training is and was involved to get you on the team?
Yeah, so there's a lot of training and still further training and development to be continued with. So currently I'm out practicing on like drones because they will be remotely piloted for the start of it. And now I've never flown a drone before in my life. So when I got to SA, I had to quarantine. And they sent me a little tiny drone to start kind of like practicing and flying with. So that was the first kind of taste of flying that I ever got.
Scary?
No, so much fun. Oh, my gosh.
I'd be so afraid of crashing into the ground.
Yeah. Little drone was so tiny that it was like, oh, I really? Got stuck in my hair. So it was. They started me really small, guys, really small.
Look, I suppose this is probably a question maybe for you, like once you do get in it, but I'm interested to know what your thinking is about this. So how do you feel about not having those usual features that you find on a track that you've been used to, like, you know, finding the perfect line to go through a corner and, you know, the rise and the fall of the track, you know, shade over the track. And then, you know, you've got the technical side of things like tire pressures and petrol and brakes to worry about. This is going to be a completely different ball game for you.
Complete game changer. Now the brakes, not having brakes, I am quite happy to not have that. I like the speed. Let's go fast. In terms of like finding the right line and everything, that's what's so exciting about it because it's a whole new sport to discover. So, and with like the competition, you know, there's already competition between us three pilots, especially the other two pilots. They've come from drone racing and drone flying before. So I like am under, I'm putting myself under pressure to try and get up to speeds to where they are. And then the competition of trying to see who's the fastest, who takes the right line, like it's all the unknown. And that's what's so exciting about it, because it's such a new challenge, and you know, you get to challenge yourself and push your own boundaries.
I'm just having a look at the Airspeeder Instagram page and going through all the different posts where they're showing the vehicles that you'll be driving, Em, and showing like the schematics of how a human actually fits in this vehicle. It's absolutely fascinating. So if for those who haven't actually seen the vehicles, you can actually view them publicly on Instagram. So I'm not breaking any rules here, I hope. But the vehicle sort of looks like the love child between a drone, a speedboat, and a Formula One car, and it's, I assume that they'll be quite large, because to fit a full-size adult, it has to be quite big. And seeing the visual comparison between some of these concepts and the engineers working on them, it's insane. It's like something out of a movie.
It's crazy. This is so cool. This is real life. When I came to the workshop for the first time, it was just crazy, because it's in South Australia. Like, you would think that this type of innovation would be overseas somewhere, like maybe in Dubai or something, I don't know. But Germany, it's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy that it's just this little place. I won't say exactly where it is, but like, it's so just not phased by, like, you just rock up, the roller doors are open, and there's the speeders.
Wow.
I suppose, when do you start?
Well, I've already started. I started in December.
Yeah.
So I started like training. So I started with the drone to start with, and then I've progressed onto a larger drone. And then in a couple of weeks, I will go onto the actual speeder itself. And then, yeah, and then that's the real stuff kind of starts happening. So it's a bit, it's not scary. I don't know what the word is, but for myself, you guys know me, you know, I've got like the Emily standards. So I put myself so high for standards in terms of, you know, racing and performance and all that stuff. And it's literally the exact same thing that I've done here, is that I see the other guys, and you know me, I don't want to be good for a girl. I want to be good for a pilot. And I mean, I'm not even like, yes, technically I am a pilot, but you know what I mean? It's just like, geez.
You're quite literally aiming for the sky with this.
Do you know, like, once you're in there piloting it, what sort of racing are we talking about? Like, is it not far off the ground? Is there a course? Is it a straight line?
Yeah, so all that stuff's being designed at the moment. So it won't be a straight line, because that'll be drag racing. We've currently already done a drag race and it was really successful. So it will be a lot of corners. There will be pit stops, which will be really exciting. Yeah, that'll be so cool. It's really cool to see, you know, the engineers and everyone like changing the batteries and all that stuff. So it will definitely be blade-to-blade racing, and it will be, you know, high enough from the sky that we can do, you know, maneuvers underneath and maneuvers over and around. So yeah, it's like, honestly, it's so cool. I'm so excited to be a part of this, because it's history in the making, and it's something so challenging and something so new that it's never been done before. So
well, look, we'll definitely be gunning for you, Em. It's really such a futuristic sort of thing, and I can't believe this sort of technology is already here already. So we'll have to stay in touch when the time comes for you to actually get in the cockpit. We'll have to get you back on and tell us the experience of what it was like. So
we wish you
all the very best of luck, and thank you so much for your time, Emily Duggan.
Thanks so much, guys. Appreciate it.
A car that is close to Scott Colley's heart, the Subaru BRZ, is back this year better than ever. Hello, Scully.
Hello, guys. It is a car close to my heart. You're right, Mandy.
Well, I suppose as a former BRZ owner yourself, how did you compare yours to the 2022 model?
I don't know if I've mentioned on this podcast a million times before, but I actually had a BRZ and absolutely loved it. So it was really cool to get to go and drive the new one. Subaru actually had the previous gen car and the new car back to back on track, which is a really interesting way to compare them. And the difference is night and day, although there are quite a few similarities. When you get them back to back on track, there really is a noticeable change.
I suppose the engine probably would be the most noticeable one, but also the price has changed. So what do you get for that price hike?
So you get torque in the engine, which, yeah, you are right, is meaningful and fixes one of the problems with the old BRZ, but we'll get to that. So, yeah, the car kicks off at 38,990 before on-roads and runs to 43,990 before on-roads. The manual BRZ-S, which is the better-equipped car with slightly different seat trim and heated seats, is 41,90, and that's the bestseller in the range so far. For that, you get an 8-inch infotainment touchscreen, and it's running a version of Subaru Starlink software that is much more modern than what you got on the old BRZ. You get factory sat-nav, you get dual-zone climate, a leather steering wheel and gear shifter, keyless entry and start, a fully digital instrument cluster that looks like a Boxer engine. It does like a little animation on startup that makes it pretend to be a Boxer, which is kind of cool if you're a nerd like I am, and LED headlights. And then, yeah, the BRZ-S gets suede under the seat trim and heated front seats. So it's not the longest equipment list in the world. The automatic also gets a full suite of eyesight active safety bits, but the manual only gets blind spot monitoring and lane change and rear cross traffic. That will be disappointing for some people. Others won't really care about AEB, adaptive cruise, that sort of thing. But for some reason, Subaru has only seen fit to fit them to the automatic.
I'm so glad that they're still stuck with rear-wheel drive and a manual transmission for all those diehard car enthusiasts. Scully, the first 500 was snapped up pretty quickly. Do we know when a next batch will be coming so people can buy this?
So orders are meant to open towards the end of the first quarter, which is the end of March, and they're meant to arrive in Australia in the middle of 2022. We don't know how many cars that will be just yet, though. The first batch was 500. Subaru says it's working with the factory to get as many cars as it possibly can, and demand is really strong, which is often the case with sports cars in their first year on sale. Once people have actually bought them and got what they wanted, though, obviously sales tend to taper off because it's not like a RAV4 or a CX-5 where there's always people who are looking for a midsize SUV. It very much is once you have one, you've got it, and you don't necessarily need to change it over.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about the engine. Tell us about it.
So Subaru, would you believe, has fitted a Boxer engine. They haven't fitted the turbocharger, but you do get 2.4 litres of displacement instead of 2 litres. It's a version of the engine they use in the Ascent SUV in the USA, but it's got the port and direct injection system that Toyota developed for the previous gen engine, and it's got more power and more torque. You get 174 kilowatts and 249 newton meters, which is up 22 kilowatts and 37 newton meters on the old model. The big thing, though, is how it's actually delivered. Peak torque is still on tap, quite high up in the rev range compared to what we're used to with turbo engines. It comes on at 3,700 revs, but when you put your foot down, there's no massive dip in the mid-range. So it still doesn't pull like a turbocharged engine through the middle, but you can put your foot down and not feel like you're forcing it to gargle bolts or to do something it really doesn't want to do, which the old one always kind of felt like in the mid-range. It never was very happy pulling from sort of 3,000 to 5,000 revs, and then it picked up again.
Scott, obviously you are a former BRZ owner, and I believe you got the opportunity to actually test the old one and the new one back to back on the Sydney Motorsport Park race circuit. So now that you've sort of touched on how the new engine delivers its power a little bit differently and a bit more strongly, how much of a difference has the new generation made since you got to drive them pretty much alongside each other?
It's really noticeable, the difference. Subaru, although it sort of indicates that this platform under the new car is an evolution of the first gen one, it's got the same wheelbase and some similar bits and pieces inside. It's stiffer, and the car only weighs 10 kilos more than before. It's got a lower center of gravity, lower ride, wider rear track, and it actually has proper tires. It's got Michelin Pilot Sport 4S as opposed to Michelin Primacy rubber on it this time. And all of those changes sound kind of incremental, and I was expecting like an incremental change on track, but it was very wet up in Sydney the day we drove, and the first car I was in was the old car, and we were behind people in the new car, and they just drove away. I don't profess to be a race driver, so there's obviously some talent involved in what they were doing as well. Molly Taylor, the rally driver, was driving the lead car, so anyone trying to keep up with her is obviously working pretty hard. But, yeah, everyone who drove the old car just got dropped instantly. And partly that's down to the fact that coming out of a corner, it just doesn't want to get up and go like the new one does. But also the traction on offer. The old car, it felt like you were managing the front end on the way into a corner, and then you'd get in, and as soon as you put your foot down, it just wanted to snap sideways. It happened quite suddenly, and it really meant that even if you breathed gently on the accelerator, you were always kind of fighting it. It always felt like it wanted to do something that you didn't necessarily want it to do, to the point where I actually managed to have a lovely, scary little moment going around one of the corners at Sydney Motorsports Park and have it go one way and then the other way, and yeah, proper code brown. And I wasn't deliberately doing it. I wasn't trying to provoke it, but I was in slightly the wrong part of the track at slightly the wrong time, and it just went on me. The new car still feels like a BRZ. You still sit down nice and low. The controls are still really beautifully weighted. The shift is still kind of short and chunky. But it's immediately noticeable that the engine is far happier to pull from down low. So coming out of second and third gear corners, you don't really feel like you're waiting for it to get going. It's far happier to roll through the mid-range. And the traction was really noticeable. So coming out of some of those corners, it was like a short circuit at Sydney Motorsports Park, and there's a little uphill S sort of section. And through there in the old BRZ, you'd kind of get it turned and then tiptoe onto the accelerator and it'd immediately want to go. The new one, you could still feel that it's overtly rear drive. You can still feel that it wants to go a little bit sideways, but you can build into the throttle and feel the car hook up and the traction build and drive out. It was really noticeable, the difference, and immediately noticeable. Not one of those ones where you go back to back and go, oh, I think the ride's slightly better in the new one. From the second you did a lap in the new one, it was really quite amazing how much of a difference there was for what is a car built on a very similar formula and similar bones. I was very, very impressed.
Awesome. Did you have a crack at both transmissions?
I did. So we had time to drive the cars on the skid pan, which was really good fun, obviously, in a rear drive compact sports car, on the road and on the track. I drove the manual on the skid pan and on the road. I had an auto on the track. Previously with the BRZ and the 86, the auto was the car you bought if you couldn't drive manual, but if you wanted to drive or you were a really keen driver or you were tossing up, the manual was the better transmission because it better suits that sort of car. I would argue that's still the case. The automatic is quick enough. It snaps reasonably well through upshifts and the paddles are on the wheel so you can flick back down the gears manually if you want to, but it's not dual clutch fast and it doesn't really have the same sort of immediacy and like just crisp feeling the rest of the car does. The manual is very, very similar to the old transmission. Subaru says they've retuned the synchros on third and fifth gear in particular, I think, but especially the second to third shift to make it a little bit smoother and faster. Realistically, there was not a huge noticeable difference for me. It could have been a bit quicker from second to third, but it feels fundamentally the same. The clutch is still light but fairly intuitive, and yeah, the pedals are still in a decent spot so that on the way down you can rev match nicely and not have to think too hard about it. So if you can't drive a manual, buy the auto. And obviously, you know, we're open for everyone here. If you just like automatic cars, that's fine. That's up to you. But 60% of people in that first batch of cars bought the manual, and I know exactly which one I'd be buying as well.
Scott, one last thing on the comparison between the two transmissions. And am I correct in saying that the manual lacks the safety systems that the automatic gets as part of the refresh?
You are, yeah. So, yeah, the manual, it's got rear cross traffic, it's got blind spot, and it's got lane change assist. It doesn't have that full eyesight suite, excuse me. Part of that, I think, is down to the fact that Subaru doesn't do eyesight on anything manual. The rest of its range is CVT now, although I'll be curious. I think the new WRX, maybe that isn't the case. I don't know why they haven't bothered with that, because it is possible to give a manual car adaptive cruise and AEB and that sort of thing. It's a little bit disappointing. I didn't miss that stuff when I owned mine, and I would wager most BRZ drivers won't miss it either. But in 2022, the expectation is that any new car will have a safety suite, and the i20N Hyundai, the Ford Fiesta ST have full ranges of kit on offer for 31, 32, 33 grand. So, yeah, I can understand Subaru's logic in not bothering to fit it or to make it work on that particular manual model if it was expensive, because it's not something that most buyers are really looking for in that sort of car. But on the other side, it's still disappointing, because having adaptive cruise is nice, and obviously AEB is life-saving tech. So to miss out on it just because it's an enthusiast car is the sort of thing that, yeah, is a bit disappointing.
It's almost impossible to find an unmodified BRZ on the road, and that's why I love it. Even the Toyota 86 is it, they're sort of like a basic sports car where they leave you room to do your own touches to it. Does this new Subaru, does this new BRZ have room for modifications?
Of course it does. Subaru already has a range of STI performance parts for it. They had a car on show at Sydney Motorsports Park. I believe these photos are on our social media. If they're not, as we're speaking now, they probably should be by the time where the podcast goes live on Monday. And it's got like a prominent pink stripe down the middle of it and a whole lot of aero bits, STI wheels, a massive swan neck spoiler, GT3 911 style on the back. I have no doubt that it'll be a matter of weeks and you'll be seeing BRZs getting around with big exhausts on the back, body kits, wings, the whole deal. that is one of the cool things about the car, and one of the things that I think makes it so appealing if you are into track days or you want to learn to go quickly is that to start with, the car is pretty friendly, and this one is even friendlier than the last car, as I've learned on the track in the wet. But they also can grow with you, and there's a huge aftermarket out there that will sell you wheels, tires, suspension, brake kits, all the way up to supercharger kits if you want to make your valves bounce through the bonnet when you go flat out. So, yeah, the car is pretty well set up for tracking to start with, and it's a great car to learn to drive in. I know that the track days I did in my first-gen car, I learned a lot from, and it was far more accessible and easier to understand why it was doing what it was doing than in some of the really expensive stuff I've been lucky enough to drive as part of this job. The new car builds on that, but there will always be ways to make it go faster and make it grippier and noisier and all that sort of thing, and that's one of the big draw cards.
Right, Scott, so the BRZ's interior, you know, being a model that's been around for quite some time, it was showing its age inside. What do you think of how the new interior compares to the old interior?
It's definitely better. It's still fundamentally very similar. It's still got a similar dash layout, but and it's still got the same seats, the same transmission tunnel layout, all that stuff. For the most part, that's really good, actually, because the seats are comfy enough that you can drive the car every day. And although it's not the most comfortable fit, tall people like me can get in there and can drive it with a helmet on. So that's a real positive. The tech has improved massively. The infotainment system now has a really clear reversing camera. It's got Apple CarPlay and Android Auto and DAB radio. And the new instrument cluster is not nearly as fancy as the system in the i20N, but it looks really cool and it's very clear and simple when you're on the track. You can get a horizontal rev counter and a big speedo there, and that's kind of all you need when you're going quickly. It's still cheap in some places. There's still some really hard, scratchy plastics and some bits that you touch and go, oh, okay, that's come from the Yaris reject bin. but Subaru's improved all the touch points. So the bits where you put your elbows are better, and they've actually put a proper Merc-style flip-open cover on the center console now. Previously, it was like an open space with a movable cup holder in there, which I know sounds like a small thing, but having driven the last one for quite a long time, quite a long way, it was really annoying because you chuck your phone and your keys in there and they'd slide around and bash your elbow. This new one's got a proper armrest with space underneath it. It's got USB ports under there as well so that the cable doesn't get tangled up with the gear stick like it used to. So Subaru has really improved on things on that front. You're still not going to get adults in the back comfortably. They're very much like in case of emergency seats, but they do fold flat so you can get skis, or I know when Toyota launched the 86, they said you could get a set of track wheels in there as well if you wanted to drive on the stock wheels to the track, chuck your sticky rubber on and then change it over again. And it still does have that over like a Mazda MX-5, for example, which is just so impractical if you ever need to carry anything bigger than a couple of shopping bags or overnight bags. You'd be amazed at what you can fit in a BRZ if you really want to. But yeah, a Fiesta ST or an i20N is going to be far more practical if you're carrying stuff around often.
So obviously you have a little bit of a bias here, Scott, in the and I say that just as a preface to my question. If you were in the market for a new, relatively affordable, sporty car, would you be looking at this, or would you be looking at an MX-5, or would you lean towards i20N, Fiesta ST, et cetera?
MX-5 is immediately out of the question for me, not because I don't like it, because I adore the car, but I'd have to put a bucket seat in there. There's just not quite enough room for me with the roof up. My head is genuinely on the roof. So, I've really enjoyed every MX-5 experience I've had. I'm driving the new one next month, I think, and I can't wait. But I couldn't own one. It's just a little bit too small for me. And I think also the BRZ is probably a little bit more grown up. It just does a little bit more than the MX-5. It feels a little bit more serious without feeling like a serious button-down car. In terms of the Fiesta ST question, I think that now I probably would buy a Fiesta ST or an i20N. I haven't driven them back-to-back yet, so I don't know which, over a BRZ, because they're 10 grand, 8 grand cheaper, and you can get more stuff in there. And the way that I use my car now, that's more important to me than when I bought the car back, would have been 5 years ago now. So yeah, I think a Fiesta ST would probably get my money over the BRZ, but that's not down to how they drive. Of the way the three drive, I take the BRZ every day of the week. It's just, it's got this really, just this awesome character about it where it wants to be thrown around and it feels overtly rear drive all the time, but it's also approachable and, you know, fun to drive without wanting to kill you. So yeah, the BRZ I think is the best driver's car of the lot. In terms of a car to live with every day and carry stuff around in, the Fiesta ST or the i20N would probably get my money. But I was sitting there yesterday on Tuesday when I was driving the car going, 40 grand, I could probably do that. I could probably, well, maybe I do want another one. So, yeah, that opinion is subject to change.
What car expert rating did you give it, Scully?
So the car got an 8.1, which sounds a little bit low compared to what we have given the Fiesta ST and the i20N. I think it's worth bearing in mind, though, the way the score is built makes it very hard for a car like the BRZ to do well. The big drawback on it is obviously its practicality. It's also fairly thirsty based on the fuel efficiency claim, and it's expensive to service. The 86 we're expecting, based on previous service pricing, to be significantly cheaper to maintain, which is a knock against the Subaru. But handling, we've given it a 9 out of 10. Fit for purpose is a 10 out of 10 and value is an 8 out of 10. And I think that's all you need to know about the car, really.
Absolutely. All right, that full review is at Car Expert now. Thank you, Scott Colley.
Thanks, guys.
There goes another Car Expert podcast. We've got a few guys over in the US at the moment. Will, what are they up to?
Yes, all of the founders are over in the US. They are working. They are attending important meetings. But they also seem to be having a lot of fun. So I don't know if listeners follow Tony and Boars and Paul on social media. But last I checked, Tony was driving the new V8-powered Jeep Wrangler, a 392 Rubicon. Paul was getting in and out of a Ford F-150 Hybrid Platinum. Boars, it's been a little bit quiet on social the past couple of days, but I'm sure he's doing something exciting as well. They're all in California. Paul also attended a Bentley launch, so the review's gone live for that. So I'm bitterly jealous, as I'm sure most of us would be, because that would be the first time those guys have been overseas in a few years, and I suspect a lot of people listening right now haven't had the luxury of going overseas during this pandemic. If you follow them on socials, check out their Insta stories and see what they're up to. It looks like they're having a lot of fun, you know, in between all the work that they're doing.
I was just going to say work in quotation marks. Yes, yes, of course it's work.
Lots of talking meetings.
Yes. Take us through the garage for next week, J-Wo.
Oh, well, take you to the garage, all right. Oh, that sounds a bit wrong. So we've got some interesting cars coming up in Melbourne ahead of the Australia Day weekend. The Australia Day public holiday, which happens to be, I think, in the middle of the week. Yeah. So we've got a Toyota Prius iTech, which will be a fun revisit given Toyota's hybrid technology started with the nameplate and now is filtered out throughout the lineup. I've got a base Kia Sorento SV6. Front-wheel drive, which will be, again, a revisit now that the car has received new badges. It's all shiny and new with the new Kia script, and obviously the segment has moved on since the car launched, so it'll be just good to, you know, revisit the car, let the consumers know where it sits. And I think it's the first time we've had a base model petrol in Melbourne, so the team can get across the V6 powertrain, because I don't think we've had a V6 in Melbourne at all. We've also got an MG ZST coming, a base Subaru Outback. We've actually gone through a couple of Subaru Outbacks. We've gone through almost the entire range bar that special edition one that was announced for MY22. I actually am in the process of writing a review on one. I just stepped out of the top of the range touring the other day, and it was my actually my first time with the new Outback to any capacity, and I was actually quite impressed. So stay tuned for the written review on that. We've got a Kia Stonic Sport in Sydney, which Kurt will be reviewing, and then Will has about 50 cars to himself. he does share some with Chris Atkinson. So he's got a Mitsubishi Outlander Exceed all-wheel drive, the Hyundai Staria Highlander, and then we've got a couple of cars in for performance reviews with Chris Atkinson, so the Hyundai i20N and Volkswagen Golf GTI. So stay tuned for that content, because Atco's thoughts on Queensland Raceway are always very interesting in cars that we generally just review on the road.
I've been playing musical cars up here because Boars is obviously out of the country and the calendar is probably as full as ever. So I've been moving cars from the office to the apartment back and forth. But I've been spoiled for choice. So it's always nice when you have a whole bunch of key fobs sitting on your desk.
I reckon you'd have like a different car every single night to take home.
Yeah.
Such a hard life, Will.
Oh, I know. But I manage. I push through.
James Wong and William Stopford, thank you.
Farewell.
Thanks, Mandy.